The one paper that has completely blew my mind when a student wrote it was a paper that compared Camus' protagonist in The Stranger, Marceau, to Deckard. It is a perfect match. Marceau starts out completely incapable of feeling anything, and he ends wanting to be empathetic, to feel the anger of the people watching him. Amazing. Well, this is not unintentional, I don't think. This is a new wave science fiction book. New wave science fiction is sort of fascinated by these notions of existentialism, especially the kind that Camus brings up. What about Roy Batty? One of my favorite characters. He's an android, and he does lots of android things. Really bad stuff. But there are a few scenes where he does things that are very human. When his lover, Ermengarde, is killed, he lets out a cry of anguish. But there's some other stuff, too. Hey, these androids actually cooperated. They worked together to free themselves from slavery. Notice, the book was written in 1966. It's the middle of the civil rights movement. Clearly, that's not unintentional. If you want proof, simply look at the commercial that's running during the Buster Friendly News Hour that says, if you emigrate to Mars now, you can have a free replica of a pre-Civil War Southern plantation, replete with android slaves. Dick's not unaware of the fact that much of the New World here in America was built by slave labor. And he's smart enough to know that probably the next world that we conquer will also be built by that slave labor. It's interesting to think about. One of my favorite characters is Isidore. Clearly, the Dick stand-in, right? Mm-hmm. He's the guy that represents Phil Dick. He stutters, socially awkward. He even has a boss who, much like Herb Hollis, Dick's boss at University Music, pushes him to deal with customers in a way that helps him out. Now, Isidore's a chicken head, which means that the radioactive dust on Earth has made him dumb. Is he really dumb? If you remember, there's this horrible, horrible scene where he finds a spider, and it's absolutely incredible. And he shows it to the androids. And they say, what's he need all them legs for? Could he walk with only four legs? Let's see. It's important to note this is not a malicious act. This is curiosity. Childhood curiosity. These are kids, babies, fully grown as androids. Eventually, Isidore drowns the mutilated spider. And who should appear? Wilbur Mercer. And hands him a fresh, new spider. The most beautiful thing about Isidore is that his first instinct is to take it outside and let it go. And at that moment, who should appear? But Rick Deckard. Rick Deckard's reaction is, what? You let a spider go? Let me get my catalog. That spider was worth about $150. Deckard's acting like an android. Isidore seems to recognize that all life should not be subject to our control and our domination, that it should be free to live out its own will. For me, an amazing moment in the text. And it shows why Isidore is our hero, for the most part in the story. And Deckard is what I would call a change character. He's a character that goes from bad to good. And that's nice. That's fairly common in Western literature. I think in part because it's Western literature, Western culture is obsessed with change. So it makes sense that we would embody that in our protagonists. What about Iran? Remember her? Boy, she's a downer. Right? She is Deckard's wife, and she's bummed out. A lot of my students, and I will admit myself, first few times, it's not a particularly likable character. Why is she so down all the time? Why didn't she just, get with it? Pick herself up by her own 2 feet. And you think about it. Iran is the kind of person that we really want to interact with. Because this world is terrible. It should be depressing. It would be inhuman not to be depressed by this empty, trash-filled, horrific husk of a world. I think that people now should be depressed that there are kids in Central America that don't have enough to eat, and so they huff gas to get high to relieve themselves of that hunger. That should sadden us. That should touch us. And yet, for the most part, we're able to live our lives in a way in which we're free from that obligation to suffer for someone else's suffering. So if you ask me, Iran's the kind of person that I want on my team. She sees the world for what it is, and she reacts to it for what it is. She's not one of these people that's going to put a big fake smile on and say, okay, well, what kind of animal are you going to buy me today? It's interesting. But the most interesting character to me is Pris. Because the whole novel has been set up to suggest that androids are androids and humans are humans because humans have the ability to empathize. But if you're a careful reader, you'll notice Pris has that ability too. In a very, very, very terrifying way. She will use her empathy to get into Rick Deckard's head to say, what is it that I can do that will hurt him the most? The answer she comes up with is, I'm going to kill his goat. This is the person that you must watch out for in life. The person who is empathetic to the extent that they may know you. But that empathy doesn't serve as a connection, but serves as a way of control. Again, talking about the way you can use humanity as a machine, make us into a machine by controlling what we want. Deckard wakes up in the morning and he programs himself to want something. This may be a little controversial, but I would be willing to speculate that if you want an iPad, that's been programmed into you. That desire to want an iPad does not naturally reside in you. One of the reasons I think that is, I don't own an iPad, but I don't see a whole lot of usefulness to it that doesn't come in a laptop. And yet, the way they market it is, you know, you're going to be reading and buying books, and, you know, you're going to be on the beach. You're going to be having this great time. How much of our desire to buy a product involves our buying into the narrative? Remember the famous marketing saying, you don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle, right? You make us want the experience. These are terrifying things. There's this really interesting, what I call squib, the beginning of the novel in all of the editions. It's an article from Reuters that came out, I would assume it's accurate, in 1966 while Dick was writing the book. It says, a turtle which explorer Captain Cook gave to the King of Tonga in 1777 died yesterday. It was nearly 200 years old. The animal called Tui Malila died at the royal palace ground in the Tongan capital of Nuku'alofa. The people of Tonga regarded the animal as a chief, and special keepers were appointed to look after it. It was blinded in a bushfire a few years ago. Tongan radio said Tui Malila's carcass would be sent to the Auckland Museum in New Zealand. Most people that I talk to, most of my students say, well, this just shows a sort of respect for animal life. It shows that it's a kind of universal, transcendent notion. I read it a little bit differently. I look at this line right here. It was blinded in a bushfire a few years ago. How many of your VU meters are swinging into the red? How many of you are touched by that idea that this beautiful, slow-moving, majestic, archaic creature couldn't get away from this fire and suffered and was burned? To me, this is what makes Philip K. Dick the most intriguing and, I would say, brilliant writer I've ever encountered. When you look at the Voight contest, there are no questions, even though Deckard says over and over, talks about questions. They're not questions. They're narratives. You're at a dinner, The entree is boiled dog. Reaction. This book is our Voight-Kampff test. All literature is a Voight-Kampff test. It's a way of keeping us tuned in to the world around us, and more specifically, tuned in to the people and the empathy around us. Eric Davis and I have had a lot of talks. He was the one that really showed me that texts are living things in these books. This is a living thing. This changes us when we read it. And I just think that's incredible. I just think that's amazing. I'd like to talk just briefly about a commercial that I saw when I was working on a long paper in graduate school about this book. It was for an investment firm. I believe they're ING or IGN. Anyway, it's an interesting commercial. A woman's older woman, she says, "Now that I've retired and I've invested in ING, I have time to do the things that I want to do." And out of the corner of the screen, this sort of herky-jerky human construct shows up with flowers. And he says, "Here are some flowers." Right? Suggesting that she's created a sensitive man that's going to give her flowers. As soon as he stretches out the flowers, smoke begins to come out of his ears. And he says, "Make me a sandwich. I don't care what you want to watch." The thing that's really crazy here, it's a funny little bit. But what they're suggesting underneath is that if you make something in the shape of a man, that its nature is created, is predicated on its shape, right? That it is the man. Once you make a person, well, that's a person. And it's as flawed and messed up and uncontrollable as any other person. It's really, really interesting to me. The depressing thing that I tell my students is that, you know, when Dick was doing the research for Man in the High Castle, one of the things that he did was he read the journals of a German officer at a concentration camp. And that German officer said in that journal, "I can't sleep because the babies are screaming." Most of our science fiction postulates the wonderful opportunities of the future. Dick's science fiction talks about the incredible desperation of the human condition. Again, imagine this. An officer at a Nazi camp can't sleep because the babies are crying. Why are they crying? Because they're being slaughtered and starved and they're cold. And yet, that man's reaction was, "I can't sleep." This is why it's important that the book focuses on the way in which Deckard acts like a robot. Ridley Scott takes it in a whole different direction. His movie is about how amazing robots can be. The real point is how much like a robot we can be. There's I read you this line where it talks about these legion of battles that took place on Deckard's face as he gets ready to go to bed. It very much reminds me of a set of lines from Matthew Arnold's poem, Dover Beach, which I know Dick read. And I don't really believe this is a conscious allusion, but it's a good one. So I'd like to just read these. At the end of Dover Beach, Matthew Arnold says, "Ah, love, let us be true to each other. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, while ignorant armies clash at night." Sorry, it's a bummer. It's a bummer. But it gets to the key. In this world, which is an absurd world, we're born into this world with this amazing ability to be reasonable and logical and just. And we're born with those capabilities into a universe that is none of those things. That's absurd. That's absurd that at every step we are over here and we're interacting with a universe that's completely out of step with our way of seeing things. But yet, we can transcend that through love, through truth, through giving. The way that I came to be a serious dickhead, as opposed to just a casual one, when I was 18, somebody gave me Scanner Darkly. I wasn't a big reader. And I said, you mean there are science fiction novels with sex and drugs in them? This is the greatest thing I've ever discovered. And so I immediately went through and read all the books in such a fast, quick succession that they all ran together, right? Well, fast forward a few years, I'm at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and I'm picking out an American literature course. I'm actually in one, and I'm at the bookstore buying the books. And the books are, I'm sure, fascinating. There's Frederick Douglass, and there's some George Washington, very political sort of books, and I'm just going, oh my God, these books are expensive, and frankly, they don't look interesting to me. And right in the, you know, this would be section over here, my teacher, the next section over, he's got this book. Right? His name was Robert Onapa. He's a great guy. He's been a mentor of mine. He's a science fiction writer. His work has been published a lot in fantasy and science fiction. And the way that he framed this book was he taught it in conjunction with T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. And then Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. And what this sets up is these texts set up a world, especially The Wasteland, which is fundamentally screwed up, sad, godforsaken. Eric and I, in driving across Nevada, were in that wasteland, right? And there's no water. As Eliot says over in rock and no water, right? That was our experience. But at the end of The Wasteland, which I teach to my students, and I always say, you know, don't kill yourself before you get to the end of the poem. It's a really beautiful, happy ending, kind of. And Eliot has a line, a set of lines in the final section of the poem. It says, "Data," which means in Sanskrit, give. He says, "What have we given, my friend? Blood shaking my heart. The awful daring of a moment's surrender, which an age of prudence can never retract. By this, and this only, we have existed." This is the key to reading Dick, in my opinion, is that in these horrible, bleak worlds, there is happiness and connection, and the key is simply love. But love is terrifying. Love is giving control. Love is making yourself vulnerable. Love is going against some of your programming. And so there really is a kind of light at the end of the tunnel for all of this. And that light is, be good to each other. Be kind to each other. Recognize that we all suffer, that we're all playing this absurd game that has no, I'm sorry to say, has no resolution other than death. But that in that world, we can live. We can be. In fact, we can be a kind of antidote to that decay by being good, by being nice to each other. And that comes from recognizing that we're all fundamentally kind of the same. People, when we look at them, could very well be robots, right? How do I know you're real? I don't.
Trust me.
Yeah. No way, buddy. Aren't we all, in some ways, robots? Programmed by the people around us, the things we learn, our social interactions? Don't those constitute programming? Don't those change the way we act and behave as time goes on? If you get your heart broken, you might be slow to love the next time. That's a piece of programming. Right? You've been programmed by what happened. I remember that. That was bad. I'm not going to rush into that again. But we can transcend that. We can go with a daring moment of surrender. We can say, okay, you hurt me once. Probably going to hurt me again. After all, this world's terrible. But I'm gonna let myself be open to that possibility. It's a wonderful message, I think. And one that kind of gets lost when we focus on the minutiae of the book, I think. You know, there's a lot to be made of Deckard's name sounding much like Descartes, mm-hmm. right?